Hey everybody, I'm Matt Valley, and welcome to the Rock and Roll Research Podcast, where we share the super cool backstories and side gigs of the research and insights pros that you trust. And I'm very excited to welcome my new friend, Joe Emery, to the podcast. Let me tell you some things about Joe. So Joe has spent his entire career pretty much in research related to corporate communications and public relations and all that good stuff. So for the past three and a half years, he's been the founder and the president of Emery Research, right? Doing a lot of that type of work, corporate communications, public relations, consulting, research, all that good stuff. But for the last 20 years, Joe has also been the lead singer, frontman, guitar player for a really, really good, cool band called The Ugly Beats out of Austin, Texas. So The Ugly Beats, they have five albums out on Get Hip Records, if I'm not mistaken. They are the real deal. So they've got this really great kind of like 60s garage punk thing going on, or garage rock with some, like maybe some Kinks and Ramones and the Easy Beats from Australia and all that kind of stuff all mixed in, and just really, really fantastic band. So we're going to talk about all that and more on today's podcast. So welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you so much for having me, Matt. Really great to be here and great to get introduced to this podcast recently.
Yeah, totally. I think it was our mutual friend, Sam Pisani, right? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Sam Pisani from the company The Logic Group. That's right. Chris Connolly was on once. Sam said, you got to talk to this guy, Joe. And wow. First time we talked, I was so blown away by some of these esoteric bands to many people that we have in common, even people that we have in common from my days in the Minneapolis rockabilly scene. You know, a lot of people move from Minneapolis to Austin, Texas because it's cooler and the music scene's a little better nowadays. So yeah, just tons of really cool stuff in common. So let's talk first about research, and then we'll get into all the good stuff. So what's your story? I know you went to UT Austin, but how did you fall into this research space, and take us a little bit on your journey?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I got into research. I came down to Austin to go to school in the mid-80s, finished with a bachelor's in English, and wasn't quite sure what to do, and lucked into a job through a roommate. I was hired as a runner at a political consulting firm that was just starting to transition to strategic communications for corporations. And a big part of the job at the time was focus groups. So when we were doing TV and radio production, I kind of got looped in, you know, proofreading reports at first, and then kind of helping with logistics for focus groups, and then and scheduling and going to focus groups, writing reports and moderators guides and screeners and all that good stuff. And over time, my responsibilities just kind of grew to the point where I was moderating them and even doing research design, writing proposals, presenting results. And so that was kind of happening all through the 90s. At the time, we did a lot of quant work as well, but most of that we would farm out. But then we brought that capability in-house right around the year 2000. You know, have been just was really fortunate to get the job, and also got to learn from some of the great communicators and researchers over the years. The guy who hired me was Mark McKinnon, who you may or may not have heard of, but he is a political consultant who now has a TV show called The Circus, which has enjoyed some success. Right. Some other people were Paul Bagala, who also has been on TV and is a communications expert. And then also had some great people they brought in to teach me the quantitative stuff. A guy named David Iannelli and another guy named Mark Allen were great mentors a couple decades ago, and they had come from a company called Market Strategies. And so learned the quantitative side from there.
Yeah, you know, I love these stories about the research space. I don't know if they're so common nowadays, now that a lot of people actually pursue research, but this is one of those great stories where you just You get in at the ground floor. You're not doing anything related to research, but you're in and around it for years, and you start picking it up, and then that becomes your profession. And that sounds like it's sort of how it's worked for you as well, right?
Yeah, it really has worked out very well. Like I said, I've been really lucky to learn from some of the best. And working at a communications firm that doesn't only do research is always kind of interesting
Yeah.
because you've got people on the sort of the client service side who are sometimes not super aware of how research works or how it's going to be valuable or important or even critical to what they're trying to accomplish. And it's nice to be able to make believers out of people and help them make their campaigns better, make sure they're serving up the right communications and using the right messengers to do those communications.
Yeah. Now, just one question about that, because I love this space. I think it's really a fascinating part of research, because often the stakes are so high. So I know some of what you work on is very long-term strategic. Here's our messaging, here's our positioning, et cetera. But then there's also the crisis communications, right? Where things are just blowing up in the media, et cetera. And somebody needs to really sit down and say, what does our messaging have to be? And that's where like the stakes are so high and the time to figure it out is so constricted. So is that some of the stuff you work on as well?
Yeah, absolutely. We had done some work for I don't think it's any secret, we did some work for the World Health Organization, right when the pandemic hit. And you had a lot of
Yeah.
media super critical. You had a lot of social media that would have had you thinking that they were hated. And before you can even begin to construct a campaign, you really need to find out what the public thinks about an organization like that. So you got to know who's aware of them, how much, whether they have a favorable or unfavorable opinion, or how much they trust them before you can even start to develop any kind of communications around that. So, in a crisis situation, research can be critical. And fortunately, campaign types have always moved quickly on this stuff, but with sort of in today's world, you can really get a toe in the water quickly and figure
Yeah.
out where things stand.
Yeah, exactly. Now you can actually get that feedback really quickly rather than have to say, okay, we don't have the time to do research. We're just going to make a decision based on gut,
Right.
right? But now you can
Yeah.
do the research and do it very quickly. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. And let's talk about the ugly beats. You guys
Sure.
are super pros. I mean, we've had lots of musicians, right, on the Rock and Roll Research Podcast, and some really, really good ones. But in terms of the bands that we've had on, yours is certainly amongst the most successful, and you've still at it and have been doing it for a long time. So tell us about that and kind of your interest in that style of music and just all that stuff.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Well, I appreciate the kind words. I don't know if I would call us pros. A couple of people in the band are pros. Our drummer, who I know you know, what we discovered when we first met, Bobby Trimble came up playing with Big Sandy Flyright in the Flyright Trio, and there it is right there. Yeah. And
There's Bobby right
very,
there.
very talented guy. We're so lucky to have him, and he is awesome. And then our organ player is actually a piano teacher, so I think you could call her a pro too. But with the exception of Bobby, I think everybody else has day careers. So being able to put out, five records so far on Get Hip, which is a really great indie rock label, it's been kicking around since the mid '80s. I think that we'd all consider that a big success. So that has been really great. 20 years together with most of the same members, it's kind of a family at this point. Nobody has a big head, and I think we all have a lot of laughs, and it's just a great creative outlet for us. And it doesn't pay the bills by any stretch, but having some records out and sort of being out there is great. And yeah, like you said, I think if anybody's kind of interested, it's rooted in the 60s for sure. We're big fans of kind of folk rock and beat rock, the Easy Beats, the Byrds, the Beau Brummels and stuff like that. But I think a lot of this kind of came up on the punk stuff too. And so I think there's
That's
no way a
definitely
little bit of
true.
Ramones influence wouldn't creep in a little bit. So it's kind of all of that. The last record we did is called Stars Align, and it's on all the streaming platforms. And I think that's fairly representative of our sound. So if anybody wants to go check that out, that would be probably a good place to start.
Yeah, I want to dig into this a little bit because I really like your sound, and it's not just the songwriting, right? Which fits in with some of the artists that you had just mentioned, and I know you do a lot of covers as well, right?
Tons, yeah.
Yeah, but part of it is the production, right? And I love that 1960s sound where, like, especially with the drums, right? Everything is wide open. The snare's got a big crack. The toms are very resonant. And somehow in the 70s, they decided to get rid of all that stuff, and it made no sense. So there's like, it feels like it's live in the room, even on the records. And so I'm curious to know how much attention you put to the actual production and getting that sound right versus just the songwriting.
Well, it's funny. When this band started, I kind of had some bands and records in mind, and bought a little bit of recording equipment, and just enough to realize I was completely over my head. So I quickly handed the reins over to some other people, and it hasn't always been the same people through the years, but there's people that kind of get us and understand what we're trying to do. One thing that is kind of interesting is that live in the room is definitely fits the room I'm sitting in is where the drums for the first three or four records were done. And we've recorded all the records here in my house. So we bring guys over here. I don't know how efficient that is compared to a real studio setting, but it definitely is more comfortable for us because we are not all seasoned professional players or studio musician types who can nail it on the first take, with the exception of Bobby Trimble, our great drummer. So definitely had some records in mind that I liked, and were able to kind of convey that to some people who already maybe had some idea what we were all about, and they helped us achieve that.
Yeah, cool. I do want to say something about Bobby Trimble, because we mentioned Big Sandy and the Fly Right Boys, whom I've been a really big fan of for close to 30 years, I want to say. And I even brought my daughter. Big Sandy played a kids show in Chicago, and I lived there, and my daughter was 1 or 2 years old, and I brought her, and we were dancing to Big Sandy. Oh, it was so wonderful. And Bobby has long been a drummer that I have greatly admired, having seen them many, many, and seen him perform many, many times live. So what a treat to have him powering the backbeat of your band.
We're very lucky. I was familiar with Big Sandy and was a fan, and was friends with his girlfriend that he got together with, who happened to live here. So he moved here to be with her. She's now his wife, and they have a son who's high school age and is a drummer also. We got to playing together in a surf band for a while, and then had an opportunity to bring him into the Ugly Beats, and kind of jumped at that. And it's been great having him. And he's just as a drummer, I'm sure you can appreciate the swing feel he brings. And it's just so interesting, even as on playing a folk rock song or even punk rock songs, there's times when I'll just kind of go out of my head for long enough to realize how much the sound swings and how much I love that sort of intangible quality he brings to it. So
I'm glad you mentioned that, because since we first talked, I have been listening to your stuff nonstop on Spotify, across all your records.
Thanks.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because there's something so interesting about what I like about it, and this is why I said you guys are such pros, because there's something beautifully simple about that genre of music, where the song construction to a listener feels like it's pretty basic, right? And a lot of the material is, boy meets girl kind of stuff or whatever. It's all pretty simplistic sort of stuff. But there's the subtlety to the feel that is so critical to make it sound so good and so appropriate for the genre. And you guys have that every time. It's like,
oh, thank you so much.
It's how that swing is and how little that swing is. Someone else could try to duplicate that, and it's like you miss everything by missing the subtlety. So
Yeah.
Going off
Well,
on a
like I
tangent here,
said,
but.
I wish I could take credit for that. I mean, but yeah, definitely the '60s kind of the '60s sound to me is just where it's at. The songwriting, the sounds, the caliber of musicianship, I don't think is ever going to be matched with what you hear in the early to mid '60s. And you know, it's always a really just a test of a good song is if it can sit. You know, if you can write a song that sits neatly between Question Mark and the Mysterians or the Standells and Neil Diamond without sounding too out of place, I think you've been successful. And so that's kind of the goal, whether we always hit it or not.
Yeah, I love that. So I know that you have a good following in Spain, and you probably still play locally. So tell me about, are you still gigging? You know, how do you like that versus like the studio experience?
There's nothing like playing live. You know, I enjoy both. I really enjoy writing and arranging songs, and it's really rewarding to hear that kind of played back when it sounds right. But there's also just that live connection, and I think that really that's just really special. Especially when you're playing this kind of music that must be seen live. There's a lot of music I really, really enjoy, including a lot of modern music that brings in a lot of electronic stuff. And some of that I can groove on almost more with headphones than listening to it on the stereo, and don't really feel like I need to see it live, even though I really like it a lot. And there's some stuff that we do that doesn't come across so well live because it's just there's just so much. There's a lot of overdubs, or they're maybe just super arranged. It's just kind of hard to achieve that. But for the most part, we just kind of go for it live and just really have a good time. So, a lot more mistakes, but still a lot of fun.
That's all right. That's part of the whole deal. So cool. So I'm curious because here you have for a long time have been doing both of these things, right? So what do you take from one that you apply to the other? Is anything that you've learned from music that you apply to your day job or vice versa?
Yeah, I mean, well, one thing I've learned is that having an outlet that involves screaming into a microphone can help you keep from getting fired at your job where you might blow your stack. So it's nice to have that, you know, but seriously though, you know, just being in a group environment with everybody contributing is key, I'd say, for any creative or work endeavor. It's a challenge for me. I've always been a bit of a control freak, and that translates to music arrangements. I'm kind of overly defending sometimes, or you know, report edits, or you know, whatever in research, a questionnaire design, you just have to learn to collaborate. You have to learn when to let go. You have to learn to play to your strengths when you need to recognize when you need help, and trust the professionals. So choose your battles, ask for help when you need it. You know, I say all of these things are things that happen in both my work life and music life.
Makes perfect sense. Makes perfect sense. And it sounds like it's worked out. What I'm surprised by is that after 20 years, you basically have very close to the original, same original members. That's not easy to pull off.
I mean, and like I said, it's a big family, really, at this point. You know, I mean, we hang out a lot. We don't play quite as much as we did pre-pandemic, and you know, people have kids, jobs, lives, soccer games, all
All
kinds of
that
other
stuff.
stuff. But piano lessons, piano recitals. We still love doing it, and I think that sort of friend connection, that's that longtime friendship, definitely carries over and comes across when you see the band live.
So having spent your pretty much entire career in research and consulting in this corporate communications era, you mentioned things moving a lot faster and all that good stuff. But from your vantage point, you know, what does the future look like? What do you see out there?
You know, this is funny. I've thought a lot about this, and it's simultaneously awesome and terrifying. I'm sure you probably can relate in a lot of ways. You know, over the past
Absolutely.
20 years especially, I mean, one amazing thing technology's done is it's just made it it's made research more affordable to do. And
Yes,
it's enabled you
absolutely.
to conduct research with specialized audiences that you could not get through traditional means, at least not for you know, not on a research budget.
Yeah.
And you know, hybrid research, all kinds of hybrid research, you know, you can do an IDI project, in-depth interviews, so much faster. You're using Zoom on the qualitative side. You can do focus
Yeah.
groups with people from all over the US. You can bring in, you know, big time specialized experts on you know, qualitative discussions that are from all over the place. And you're not dependent on people who live on the north side of the river in one city,
Right.
you know.
Yeah.
Just Zoom can make a 30 IDI project a little bit less painful, maybe not completely painless, but you know, data quality and fraud can be a bit of a concern when you're spending thousands on a survey, and sort of filtering out bogus respondents can be a constant challenge. So you do have to work really hard, maybe harder than you used to stay a step ahead of that. And that's maybe a bit of where I have to manage my own personal expectations and rely on good vendors like our mutual friend Sam Pisani and Logit Group, who do a really, really good job of that. I'm skeptical to a fault and used to drive colleagues crazy a lot of times,
Yeah.
questioning whether you could really get respondents at a level that a lot of people would tell you they could. You know, the new tools are amazing. I have not looked closely at ChatGPT, but I have heard from colleagues that are using it to write moderators' guides for focus groups. They'll even feed in transcripts and have it do first drafts of reports, which is amazing. And
Yeah.
I don't know if it's ever going to get you more than 50 or 75% of the way there. Maybe it will.
Yeah.
But if that saves you time, a lot of times, you know, you can only charge a certain hourly rate. And so that makes it where you can do that. And you know, I mean, it can help from an organizational standpoint. I don't know if others have this experience, but a lot of times when you are covering six or seven topics in a research project, there's a lot of bleed over. There's a lot of overlap, and it can be a challenge to trying to figure out how to organize it all into a report because everything kind of goes together. And I think some AI technology can kind of maybe help in that regard. And to sort of bring the future of research and rock and roll worlds together, something that's happened since I first met you that I thought I would mention that is just crazy is that just earlier this week, someone sent me a version of the AC/DC song "You Shook Me All Night Long," where they had used AI to change the singer from Brian Johnson to Bon Scott.
Oh
So there's a
my.
version, and it's convincing. It's crazy. It's terrifying, but in this case, it's really awesome. So
Oh,
it's convincing, and
dude.
it sounds great. Yeah, crazy.
have
So Bon Scott singing "You Shook Me All Night Long," and I think maybe this is the kick in the pants that I need to really go get on ChatGPT for a weekend and see what I can learn and see how I can use it to make my life easier and maybe expand my capabilities in research as well. So there's
Okay,
that.
so far that sounds like the best use of AI that I've ever heard. So I'm gonna rush out and listen to that after we finish
Yeah, the
this.
first thing, and that song has a long intro, right? There's a good
Yeah.
probably 20 seconds to some, like, all right, and then finally I'm like, what? I can't believe it sounds exact. It's him. It's his voice, you know. I mean, there's a few little digital artifacts here and there, but man, what that can do is just crazy.
Oh,
And if you
that's
use the power for good like that, you know.
maybe we can interject David Lee Roth into all the Sammy Hagar era, Van Halen, all kinds
Yeah.
of good stuff.
Yeah. No, not to diss Brian Johnson, but there's already about another half dozen post-Bond songs that I would love to hear his vocals substituted in
Yeah.
for. So just to hear what it sounds like, if nothing else. But
Super
anyway,
cool.
so yeah, there's the future. There's the future right there. And like I said, it can be terrifying, but I have heard from some colleagues that I've been working with for a long time that they're using ChatGPT, and it's been very, very helpful. So.
Yeah, cool. Really interesting. So, So yeah, this is media, right? You've been talking about media, AI, all that good stuff. But hey, this is a podcast, right? I don't know if you listen to podcasts or what other kind of media you consume, but I'm really curious to know, you know, with your limited time, you know, what media gets your attention?
I am a podcast junkie. But for media, a lot, you know, I watch a lot of guitar pedal videos on YouTube, way more
Yeah.
time than I spend practicing. Not quite, but more than I should. But no, I'm on Twitter way more than I should be, and I kind of hate to see where it's going these days because it can be such a great resource in so many ways. But it's still kind of the big dog out there for finding information. A big part of what I do in research is communications, and a lot of
Right.
that is message testing, figuring out the best way to tell your story. And it's critical to be able to do that briefly, because in a soundbite's 5 to 8 seconds long, a TV spot,
Right.
to the extent that you have those anymore, is 30, and you see a lot that are 10 to 15 seconds
Yep.
on a lot of the streaming channels. So you got to be able to tell your story effectively and briefly. And so Twitter's a way to do that. Their Twitter kind of gives you some handle on people that can use a creative medium, or use a medium where you have to be short very creatively. Instagram too. Instagram videos can really, I mean, it may seem like a stretch, but you can get a lot of inspiration watching just stand-up comics and who have maybe have some unique perspective on what otherwise is a mundane topic. And a
Definitely.
lot of time that short form comedic videos where they're able to get a point of view across very succinctly, and it can be really valuable, and you just get kind of a nice flavor of different ways to communicate. So that's
Definitely.
going to be the excuse, my excuse for being on Instagram videos more than I probably should be. But you know, I'm also just really, really lucky to have through the years and still get to work with former reporters and media relations experts who kind of are able to dumb down a lot of these complicated issues for public consumption,
Sure.
on like electric utilities and the environment and water and stuff like that. So you know, it's always just kind of looking at how people are able to communicate in a unique and compelling way, and brief way. And so that's a lot of my media consumption. But then otherwise, you know, I'm on podcasts on music and true crime and all the usual suspects. So
Well, it's kind of nice when Instagram comedy videos dovetail with your work and you can learn from them, then you got an
yeah.
excuse. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can, like I said, you can discover a lot of that, and even just short form videos that are funny or
Yeah.
just edited together creatively. So yeah, there's always
You
something to learn from that stuff.
know, our guest on episode number 93, Lee Kessler, was a stand-up comic, and he really convinced me of that. Like, sort of the brilliance of how much you're conveying in such a short period of time as a comic. Because in order to be funny, you have to establish a context, and you have to communicate something about the messenger, right? And so
Yeah.
you use all of these devices to be able to do that and communicate something so quickly that there's really an art and a bit of a genius to it.
There is, and those guys are doing their own focus groups if they're workshopping in material. And I know a lot of those
Yeah,
guys are, right? They're,
exactly.
they'll they'll go out and tell a joke 30 different ways
Yeah.
until they can kind of figure out the most compelling way to do it. And with message testing, that's what you're doing. You're trying to figure out the best language you can use, the most compelling argument, and what may seem obvious to you may not play at all with others. And especially, you know, intuitively, I kind of tend to go one direction, but I'm ideologically and politically very far left. And so I am sometimes find myself scratching my head and very surprised to learn that what may seem like the most compelling reason to have a certain go a certain way on a policy issue is not the same reason why others feel that way. So,
Right. Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the beauty of research, right? Is that it's about understanding, you know, really trying to understand, you know, even people who think so much differently than you do, being dispassionate about that and distilling it down, right? So that you can help your clients and all the good stuff.
Yeah,
Cool.
and by the same token, you put them in the back room at a focus group, and what may seem like they're just 100% sold on some certain thing. or convinced that everybody understands their super niche issue, and having them watch a room full of people not understand it or not be swayed by what they think is the most obvious message can be very useful.
Yeah, yeah, totally. All right, Joe, here's the big question, of course. I'm just so fascinated to learn what your answers are going to be to this one, right? It's my favorite question to ask. So let's have it. I'm sure you've been asked it 1,000 times before, but you're stranded on a desert island, right? You have 3 records of your choosing, at your disposal to keep you company for the rest of your days. What are those records?
Such a hard question. It's a bit of a challenge. And you think about this, and it probably changes day to day. I think today's answer is probably the first Ramones record, The Ventures in Space.
Yes.
The Bo Brummel's Volume 2, just the greatest folk rock record ever. If you ask me tomorrow, I know this is probably cheating, but that would probably be the first Real Kids record, Nick Drake, Pink Moon, and maybe AC/DC Powerage. I will go to day 3 because I've already given you 6 instead of 3. It's kind of cheating. That's bad. I know. It's my way out.
It's okay, right? It's okay because all 6 could capture in the episode here, but you know, I record the top 3 mentions, and I've got the quantitative data for that. So thank you for mentioning some punk rock. We've got some Ramones on there. I love it. So very good mentions. I'll make sure to record that for you. And it's good stuff.
Now, nice to see them represented.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, one last thing I wanted to say is I am wearing this shirt, Kick Butt Coffee, for a reason. Because it is not far from where Joe lives in Austin, Texas. I've also played there a few times. And it happens to be, if anyone heard about this, but at IIEX in Austin earlier this year, we did a little punk rock field trip after the last day. And I took a group of market researchers out for some really awesome punk rock at Kick Butt Coffee on a Thursday night. It's such a great venue. So if you find yourself in Austin, make sure you stop by Kick Butt. You'll have some great punk rock and awesome coffee. So I can't beat it.
It's a great venue. I appreciate you flying the flannel and representing Austin for this taping. I'm honored.
Got to do it. Awesome. Well, Joe, let's definitely talk soon. I can't wait to see you when I play there again in August, it looks like.
Looking forward to that, for sure.
But hopefully we talk before then. Let's catch up. Rock and roll.